Front, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and this week, earlier this week, we attended a, it was an invitation from our affiliate and our associate, Tarla McConnell. We actually thought we were going to a rather small gathering to meet with Ireland's most famous sculptor in Rowan Fergus, Meredith Gillespie, who we'll be speaking with in a little while. And when we got there, actually, we found that the Ancient Order of Hibernians had a huge gathering at the old St. Patrick's Cathedral, the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral down on Mulberry Street. Delighted we were indeed to catch up with the boss man, Monsignor Donald Sacano, who is the pastor. And Monsignor, you're very welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Can you take us from where we are sitting this evening and maybe bring us back 200 years? 199 years.
Yes, if you know this area of New York City, Lower Manhattan, this was pasture, orchards and cow paths. When you think about it, the year 1800, the city of New York was a little backwater burg, little town at the end of Manhattan. The United States was a conglomerate of colonies just struggling out of a Revolutionary War. And the church was a very small group of people. That was 1800. 1900, just 100 years, and that's not a long time. The city of New York was five boroughs and was millions of people. The United States was a major power, and the church was bursting out of its seams with enthusiasm and a lot of that happened here, right here, at the crossroads of Mulberry Street and Prince and Mott, this little corner of the world. So it was orchards then, but it grew rapidly, and the leadership of Archbishop Hughes, the first Archbishop of New York, is what we came here to commemorate this evening.
Archbishop Hughes would have been, as history records, first of all, an immigrant, somebody who was not welcomed with open arms. He tried, as we learned, he actually wanted to be a seminarian. He wanted to be a priest. Nobody made it easy for him.
No, in fact, he started off as a laborer. He was a gardener for the Sisters of Charity in Emmitsburg. But you know, there are people in history that are born with genius. And think of Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln was not a highly educated person in terms of, you know, academia.
Right.
And yet he had an innate ability to write and to speak. He was eloquent, and so was John Hughes. He was an eloquent person who was able to articulate his times. He had a feel for the needs, but he saw a vision for where people needed to go.
Was he considered arrogant? He was firebrand.
arrogant. Well, you know, there's an appropriateness for being proud, you might say.
Yeah.
You know, and certain people might think that's arrogant, but he was an appropriate person, and he was appreciated by the way, President Lincoln, who used him as unofficial ambassador to the European powers during the Civil War in an effort to keep them out of the war on behalf of the South. You know, so Lincoln befriended him and appreciated his work as a leader.
Who did the now Archbishop Hughes, who did he replace? Who preceded him?
A bishop by the name of John Dubois, the only non-Irish bishop ordinary head of the diocese in our history. So John Dubois was the bishop immediately before him, the third bishop of New York.
Uh-huh.
And they both lived, John Dubois and Archbishop Hughes, simultaneously in the house that I live in, where we are now speaking to one another.
We will move on, but I would like to point out that Bishop Dubois was less than thrilled with his tenant, his new tenant.
Yes, yes. The Pope assigned him an assistant because he was failing in health. So there was a little, one was a French aristocrat, Bishop Dubois, and the other, hardened man, John Hughes, who was brilliant in the skills God gave him.
He also, of course, was a great friend of the emigrants.
Yes.
And in particular, he was very vocal and supportive and didn't put a tooth in it, so to speak, with respect to the plight of the Irish immigrant who
cool.
was
yes.
now, who are now fleeing Ireland, fleeing the famine.
Yes.
And in one, I'm paraphrasing, but not by too much, Archbishop John Hughes, when asked about the Irish and when asked about what was happening in Ireland and, these hooligans that were stealing Trevelyan's corn and, doing all that horrific stuff, John Hughes said that man's first obligation is to his family. And whatever means that takes is what he is, in the eyes of the Lord, expected to do, which pretty much in hindsight was interpreted as here you have, an Archbishop of New York who was in one sense, basically absolving what was going on in Ireland. Probably one of the earliest quotations from somebody of that stature to say, they're not all a bunch of scoundrels and whatever. He established, and that, of course, is only one of the smaller quotes that we, in terms of hundreds of them, did seem like he was the firebrand that probably epitomizes his very character. That's what he was.
Very definitely. Very definitely. In fact, you can see a little glimpse of him. I hesitate to reference a film that I didn't like because of its violence, but The Gangs of New York, was a wonderful book that preceded it that describes the communities of New York City and their rougher and tumble way. But there is a scene in the movie where John Hughes rallies the Hibernians to defend this church, the church that I am now privileged to be pastor of, against the nativists who intended to desecrate the church. So he was a defender and put his own body on the line.
And brand on it.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
With an edgy, one would have to say, you didn't have to guess at what exactly he was saying.
No, he was very clear.
Can you fill us in on how this became a basilica?
Well, in a word, Cardinal Dolan. I think Cardinal Dolan, the newly installed Archbishop of New York, looked around for, and an historian himself, Timothy Dolan.
Yeah.
And he saw this old cathedral as being the mother church, and although we're not the breadth and the size of the basilicas of Europe, our history,
in Knock County Mayo, which
as you know, great things come in small packages. Being a small man myself, but as a small church, it contains a powerful message. And I think they put the badge of basilica, which is an honorific title, onto St. Patrick's Old Cathedral.
200 years, and Monsignor, I know we'll be seeing a lot of you, and indeed you're getting a lot of support from those who are here this evening.
Well, now, I'm so heartened by the support that Bill Duggan and the Friendly Sons at Morristown have given us. And I can't wait for our anniversary celebration, which is really the anniversary of our dedication, on November the 22nd, 2015.
A year away and a bit. Okay. I want friends to bring in Bill Duggan at this point. Bill Duggan, Friendly Sons of St. Patrick's, Morris County, New Jersey, Knights of Columbus, and indeed... I noticed that several people were kind of going for their, keeping their hands on their wallets this evening. You did let the word go out that, you know, that this 200th anniversary is coming up rapidly, but you need to, somebody's got to pay the piper here as well.
Yes, that's right, Adrian. And, you know, the interesting part of this whole project that we've embarked on well over a year ago is that people ask, why the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick of Morris County? What did Archbishop Hughes have to do with Morris County, New Jersey? Well, I'll tell you what Archbishop Hughes had to do. At the time of his episcopal, back in the mid-1800s, the jurisdiction for Archbishop Hughes included not only New York, but also northern New Jersey. And our parish in New Jersey, in Morristown, the parish of the Assumption, St. Mary's of the Assumption, was built by immigrant Irish in the 1840s, the early 1840s. And it was Archbishop John Hughes who came out at that time, traveled from here in this very right. campus all the way out to little Morristown, New Jersey, to consecrate and bless our church. At that time, Morristown, New Jersey was a very well-heeled and very popular area for people to sort of get out of the city and get out of the areas to the higher elevation. And there was numerous immigrant Irish that were there, and those Irish were chambermaids, they were nannies, they were gardeners, they were ditch diggers, they were whatever could be done to help support the communities that were there at the time. So there's a very tight connection between Morris County, New Jersey's Assumption Parish and this Archbishop Hughes himself. So we're all proud to be part of that.
Now, in the in preparation again for the bicentennial for the 200th anniversary, it was the AOH who actually commissioned our guest of honor here this evening, sculptor supremo Rowan Gillespie, and tell us about how that's developed.
Yeah, so
the Friendly Sons.
Right, so the Friendly Sons, about a year ago, we approached Monsignor with an idea to do something to thank our heritage for everything that has been happening over the years, and we wanted to give back. And we quickly collaborated with the AOH because this would not have been a proper event without incorporating the AOH. And the AOH New York chapter is a fellow by the name of Tom Byrne. And Tom and I and Monsignor, we sat down and we had some very fruitful discussions about what we'd like to do. Monsignor had a vision, and we worked diligently over the last year and a half collaboratively with the AOH to put this together. And this is our first event tonight. And, you know, we're so honored to have Rowan Gillespie, the world-known sculptor from Ireland, here. And he's really lit the crowd up tonight. And as you earlier mentioned, there was expected to be few, but there's quite a good turnout tonight and a lot of enthusiasm. So that's the connection between the AOH and the Friendly Sons.
Friendly Sons. And to that, friends, I would I'd very much like to get around to speaking with Rowan Gillespie. And but If we can get Tarla McConnell, who is... What are you hustling around here for? Would you sit down? Okay. Tarla, we have known, of course, through our own association, Rowan Gillespie much better than he knows us, in the sense that he has made his mark not only in Ireland as a world figure as a sculptor, but the Caves and Quinnipiac University,
right.
World traveler.
Right.
Introduce him.
Well, Adrian, great to be here at the table with Monsignor, with Rowan, with yourself, and on a great night for New York, because we have Rowan Gillespie launching a memorial that's going to be part of the New York scene going forward. Rowan is, as all of us, anybody who's been to Ireland for the last 17 years will have seen the famine sculptures on Dublin's quay. And it is monumental in terms of the impact that it has had on how he conveyed both the famine victims, the victims of hunger, and also the spirit of emigration. I first became aware of Rowan's work way back, even before that, because he is collected by some of America's great collectors, and one in particular, Brian Burns, who
absolutely,
I speak of often.
Yeah.
Brian has many, many pieces of Rowan's. Brian and Eileen are great champions of Rowan's work. And the other person who's a great champion is John Leahy, the president of Quinnipiac University. And John is very proud that the first piece of art that he bought for the collection of Quinnipiac that would eventually evolve into a museum,
right,
was a piece that Rowan did, a little piece called The Victim, and this, which I call The Survivor, because it kind of has the spirit of every young person who has ever come to America. And John started John loves to tell, this is pre 9/11. John tells about coming back on the plane with that sculpture on the seat beside him. He couldn't do that today. So that's when Rowan became an important figure in the life of the art world for me. So when I met with Monsignor and the committee, going back a few months ago, and they were considering a commission, they had seen one of Rowan's pieces, a beautiful piece called The Captain, Sea Captain, up at the Irish Consulate, an exhibition that I produced at the time. And Monsignor and the committee realized that there was something important with this artist. So that began the introduction of Rowan. And you know, I could go on, because there have been books and documentaries made about him, but I think there's nothing better than hearing from the man himself.
You're very welcome to the program, Rowan.
Thank you very much.
Let me just delve back a little bit into you as the toddler and your dub.
I am, yeah. I was born in Dublin, but I actually left at 3 months old.
That was a wise decision.
It was an essential.
I can say that only half in fun and half in earnest, because when I emigrated to America, the rest of the family emigrated to Dublin, got cold feet, and that's as far as they got. So it has become a great sense of some one-upmanship from that day to this.
Well, unfortunately, my family's got a history of going backwards and forwards. My great-grandfather emigrated in the famine. Then my grandfather came back again.
Really?
Then my father emigrated, and I decided to go back again. So we keep trying it again, and my son has left. So we're sort of on that track.
But sooner or later, we all settle, they say. It hasn't happened yet. But in terms of when did you realize that you had this God-given talent, which, you know, for many artists, there's an easier path. You walk in, you listen to music, or you read something or whatever. A sculptor...
Well, in fact, I was brought up in Cyprus, the first 10 years of my life, which was a war-torn country with the problems between, well, first getting the British out and then the Greeks and the Turks. So I was brought up inside a sort of closed compound with guards at the gates nearly all the time, and very lonely as a little boy. So I learned, I took the sandstone they had there and I used to carve it with a penknife. I used to whittle away, and I was very happy. And I actually saw bronze being cast for the first time, or rocks being taken from the copper ore. Cyprus is known as the island of copper. And they used to take lumps of rock, put them in crucibles, heat the rock, and then pour off the copper which came from it. It was alchemy in an extreme. And I just loved to watch. And the funny thing is, that's what I do every day today. I melt blocks of bronze and I pour out that beautiful copper-colored liquid. So it's there from the start.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned the word there, lonely. There are some sculptors and some critics who say that you're a loner to this very day, in the sense that you are the creator and you are, you know, you carry that right through to the very end. I'm sure somebody must have said it's too bad he wouldn't delegate some of that, but that's not what you're about.
Well, I'm just a very bad delegator. I think that's the other way of looking at it.
Well, it could also be, you know, nobody wants to work with you, but
that's probably
either
true
way
too.
Either way, it's what you do.
It is what I do. It's the only way I know how to do it. I'm not alone when I do things, because whoever I'm working with, and my favorite thing is to find people in the workshop. I've worked with James Joyce, I've worked with Gerard Manley Hopkins, with W.B. Yeats, with Jesus. I've had a lot of different people, and I talk to them.
You're name dropping, but
Jesus is quite a guy to have in the workshop with you.
You're in good company there.
Hmm.
You're told,
and I like being alone with them.
Yeah, you did tell a little story this evening. I think that despite the fact that this is a very nice and jovial party here. That sent a silence through the crowd, and it had to do with the Trinity and your being either unaware that through some strange part of your being you wound up with three pieces of sculpture that others, if not you, others brought to your attention, epitomized the Holy Trinity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that it took me by surprise when somebody said that, because I went out and cut the grass, which I don't normally do. You know, it was completely out of character thing. That I was brought up a Quaker, okay? And there's a concept in Quakerism that if you speak at a Quaker meeting, you should stand up first because you feel moved, and then you say the words that just come to you. I suppose they would say, God speaks through you. Now, I can apply that into sculpting sometimes, that I'd say you just sculpt. You don't question why I'm sculpting. You sculpt, and you trust that it comes to you. And I slightly wonder if that happened on this occasion.
What
I didn't know why I made what I made.
What was the commission? What did you set out to do? And
to make a statue of Archbishop Hughes. So I did go quite far away from the brief.
So he's still pushing his weight around.
I don't know. Monsignor would probably have more to say on that.
I don't know if he even wants to get in on this conversation, but But there is something haunting and fascinating, you know, about that whole concept. But it does kind of bring us back to what a sculptor does, you know. And maybe it happens to many artists in different spheres. But with the sculptor, somehow we have to see something. There is a creation there. There's something that you actually have to bring to life.
There is, yeah. I mean, the truth with sculpture is that it is 1% inspiration which goes into a public sculpture and a huge amount of hard work. But you need to be receptive and available for that moment whenever it comes. And, well, I don't know. We're just on the beginning of the journey here. We don't know where it's going to go. Things will evolve a lot from.
Are we getting too deep here for you, Turner?
I just wanted to comment on another set of sculptures that Rowan recently did that were unveiled at Boston College about a year or so ago.
Right.
On the four Nobel laureates. And I think that Rowan's process on that was not only did he create likenesses of our four laureates, Yeats, Shaw, the other two, Beckett and Heaney. Not only did he create the likeness of those four individuals, those great writers, but he also brought out the words of these writers on the pedestals. And so suddenly you get this words and image that was so important. And what I think that many of us are sort of taken by is that we just feel that Rowan in his work is not just going to give us the likeness of Archbishop Hughes, the likeness of a famine orphan, and then his interpretation of the spirit, but we also know we're going to get some of Hughes's words, and that's very exciting because Hughes is known to those who really study him as a great writer. He was a great writer and a great thinker. And so I think in Rowan's work, you get not just the likeness, but you get the character of the essence of that individual. And we saw that in Boston. We see that in Boston at the Burns Library. But we're hoping to see that on Prince Street here in New York.
Rowan, I wanted to ask you, and everything we've said is obviously not only is it true, and but we're enthused and excited about it, particularly this evening. This is the launch of what we know in little more than a year's time will become a reality. I want to ask you about, as a sculptor, what happens when you are heading in a direction and you've kind of lost the original notion, the idea, and now you are, is there a point as a sculptor where you have to kind of back into what is already there, maybe change course along the way? What happens if you screw up?
Well, I think the concept of screwing up on a public sculpture is too awesome to take into the studio with you when you're working. So I have a very simple way around that one. Nobody pays money up front on a sculpture. I don't take a deposit. Yeah. I make the sculpture, and then I say, take it or leave it at the end. That is only for the reason of taking that weight off me in the workshop.
Yeah.
It's somehow saying, if I screw up, you're allowed to say, you screwed up on this one and we don't want it.
I see. Okay.
So is it
much more difficult as a sculptor to maneuver as you go along? I mean, if you start off with the seed, you have the thought process, you have a clear image in your mind, but do you have the flexibility somewhere along to get is there room for another inspiration?
There's always, when Turlough talks about the words, for example,
mm-hmm.
I do a lot of engraving of words and things like that. Selecting the words can come at a very late stage in the process.
Right.
But the actual shapes, the actual overall thing, that will be pinned on in at a very much the beginning stage. That won't change. It will only be the
textures, will be, yeah.
The colors, the things like that.
Throughout the world, it must be nice and very rewarding in your chosen field to get the recognition that you know that you have achieved up to this point. And you have taught us to expect great things from you. So
I shouldn't have said that.
Hey, listen. You're raising the bar, and it's your own fault. But we expect great things. And again, you have been duly acknowledged, and we're delighted. Delighted also that you're going to be, a part of very much a part not only of New York City, but of the Archbishop, the great Archbishop John Hughes. And, of course, the cathedral, Old St. Patrick's Cathedral on Mulberry Street. So pretty soon you're going to have to get back to work.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Thank you.
Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. This is not a commercial, but we just want you to know, friends, that the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral on Mulberry Street in New York. They're looking for some participants to make this bicentennial a great occasion. And trust me, when we say 200 years ago the Irish rallied, and we wouldn't want to let ourselves down this time around either.